Okay, so I'm super excited about the episode today. It's a bonus episode. We're just talking about the movie Creepshow. It was the first time I've ever seen it. Some of the references are going to be from IMDb and Wikipedia. So, Creepshow comprises of five distinct stories: Father's Day, The Lonesome Death of Jody Verrill, inspired by King's book Weeds, Something to Tide You Over, The Crate, which is inspired by The Crate, which is a story by Stephen King. And They're Creeping Up on You. These tales were either adapted from King's own words or created as original content for the film. Throughout the movie, a young boy named Billy, played by Stephen King's son Joe, is punished by his abusive father for indulging in a horror comic, framing the narrative with prologue and epilogue scenes. This is actually the only George A. Romero film where he didn't write the screenplay, which is super cool to know. Stephen King wrote the screenplay, and I'll get more into that in a second. A fun fact is the iconic 10-cent Creepshow comic book showcased in the film was skillfully drawn and inked by renowned artist Jack Kamen, who had previously worked on the original EC Crimes and horror comics of the 1950s. This movie served as a heartfelt tribute to those influential comic books. Additionally, Kamen lent his artistic talent to create the comic book style poster for the film, which also graced the cover of Plume Creepshow comic book adaptation. Interestingly enough, Stephen King initially desired Graham Ingalls, who was another esteemed EC artist known for his exceptional work on The Haunt of Fear, to create the poster artwork. Since he wasn't available and he declined the offer, it was actually William M. Gaines, who was the head of EC Comics, who suggested Jack Kamen for the task, and he gladly accepted the assignment. He was super excited about it. So, drawing inspiration from the EC horror comics of the 1950s, including Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and The Haunt of Fear, Creepshow plays tribute to that distinctive style. Director Romero enlisted the expertise of seasoned special effects artist Tom Savini, who skillfully recreated comic-like visual effects. So Warner Brothers implemented a unique release strategy for the film that ultimately had a lot of success. In July of 1982, they strategically selected several theaters in the Boston, Massachusetts area for a limited run of the movie. The film garnered impressive sales and generated strong word of mouth, prompting Warner Brothers to conclude this initial phase. Recognizing that the main competitor of horror genre at the time was Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which came out in 1982, they expected like a large group of people to go to the movie, and then eventually a decline because Halloween was going to be over. So they were assuming that there was going to be a large group of people going to that movie. So they decided they didn't want to release their movie during Halloween time because that movie would get the most viewership. So what they decided to do instead was they released it in early November. Warner Brothers correctly predicted that horror film market would remain receptive to a new offering shortly after Halloween. And they believed Creepshow would enjoy substantial success through the final months of 1982. And they were right about that. So in the United States, the film got $21 million in revenue. And this success prompted a sequel in 1987 titled Creepshow 2. And it actually was directed, Creepshow 2 was actually directed by the cinematographer from the original Creepshow. And it was written by Romero and was based on stories by Stephen King. And they made a third installment, Creepshow 3, released in 2006, but it didn't do it as good. It didn't have the collaboration of either Romero or King, so it didn't do as well. Okay, so I'm just going to go over each story and then do some fun facts about each of them. So the prologue, Stan, an abusive father, punishes his young son Billy for reading a horror comic called Creepshow. Concerned about the comic's inappropriate content, Stan angrily throws it into the garbage. Upstairs, Billy resentfully wishes for his father to suffer in the depths of hell. Suddenly, a noise captures his attention at the window. To Billy's surprise, the cause of the disturbance is none other than the Creep, the eerie host of the comic book. The Creep gestures for Billy to approach and uncovers the lid of the trash can. During a break in filming, Stephen King took his son to a McDonald's, and as a joke, Joe was made up with bruises, cuts, and scabs. And the girl at the drive-through window was super concerned and called the police when she saw him, which I think is good on her, first of all, but also what a prank. Stephen King is his It's funny because he is humorous, but not really in the way that most people would be humorous. And his comedy is not the same as my comedy, personally. But I do love watching Stephen King movies. I love scary movies. So I really appreciate his writing. So the first episode is entitled Father's Day. At the Grantham estate, Sylvia Grantham introduces her nephew, Richard, and niece, Cass, to Cass's husband, Hank Blaine, during the family's annual dinner on a June Sunday. They proceed to share with Hank the family's dark secret about great aunt Bedelia, who allegedly murdered her abusive father, Nathan Grantham. Nathan had acquired the family's wealth through illegal activities such as bootlegging, fraud, extortion, and murder for hire. Years ago, Bedelia had endured a life of emotional abuse from her father, which worsened after she became his full-time nurse following his stroke. Nathan's cruelty peaked when he orchestrated a fatal hunting accident to eliminate Bedelia's fiancé, Peter Yarbo, and maintained control over her. On Father's Day, driven to a murderous rage by Nathan's insults and demands, Bedelia bludgeoned her father to death with a hidden marble ashtray. In the present, Bedelia arrives at the Grantham Manor and visits her father's grave in the family cemetery. In a drunken state, she reminisces about the murder and reveals that Sylvia had staged it as an accident to steal Nathan's fortune and distribute it among the family. Accidentally spilling her whiskey bottle, Bedelia is shocked when Nathan's reanimated corpse emerges from the grave, still demanding his Father's Day cake. He strangles Bedelia in revenge and proceeds to kill the rest of the family, telekinetically crushing Hank with a gravestone and twisting Sylvia's neck. He also murders the Grantham's cook, Mrs. Danvers, possibly to cover his tracks. As a grotesque final act, Nathan presents Cass and Richards with a Father's Day cake made from Sylvia's severed head adorned with candles. The film's ending remains ambiguous, freezing on Nathan's gloating over a terrified Cass and Richard. However, the comic book adaptation suggests that Nathan plans to harm them further by blowing out their candles. So, just some fun facts about that episode. Rice Krispies were used as maggots on the corpse's eyes in the story, as addition to real maggots, which is disgusting. But I was like, Rice Krispie treats? I mean, I would have been cool enough just seeing Rice Krispie treats in the scene, but... In the segment Father's Day, an intriguing phenomenon occurs when Aunt Bedelia accidentally spills the whiskey onto her father's grave, causing him to come back to life. The curious connection between whiskey and the revival of the deceased may hold a deeper meaning. In the Irish language, whiskey is translated as the water of life, a term that could potentially pay homage to the renowned author James Joyce and his literary masterpiece, Finnegan's Wake. In this novel, a significant event takes place when a builder's laborer tragically falls from a ladder, resulting in a fatal skull fracture. However, during his wake, a miraculous occurrence transpires where someone inadvertently spills whiskey onto his lifeless body, causing him to be revived. Notably, the narrative of Finnegan's Wake draws inspiration from an old Dublin street ballad, adding yet another layer of cultural significance to the connections between whiskey, resurrection, and folklore. So this episode was wild for me. I think Stephen King does a good job at setting up like a dysfunctional family feel. He does it a lot throughout his books where the family is dysfunctional, and that adds an extra layer of suspense and uneasiness throughout. Because, I mean, if the family was a functional family, they'd be able to band together and fight the antagonist together. But since they all went out one by one and they didn't trust each other, it became a problem. But I liked this episode overall. It was way scarier than I thought. Everybody was saying, oh, it's a really scary movie. Obviously, there's some like comedy aspects to it. It's kind of reminds me of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark a little bit. I mean, but darker, obviously. But just where the stories are just so silly, like with Nathan at the end, just where's my cake as a zombie. It's funny, but also super dark. Dark comedy like Stephen King's comedy that we see throughout his books and stories. The second episode is called The Lonesome Death of Jodie Verrill. Jodie Verrill is played by Stephen King. He is so funny in this role. At first, I was like, man, his acting needs work. But then seeing kind of like how he was told to play Jodie was pretty interesting. It made me realize his acting was a little bit better than I thought. So I'm going to go over the story and then I'm going to go through some fun facts. Jodie Verrill is a simple and foolish country bumpkin portrayed by Stephen King. He witnesses a meteorite crash on his farm. Intrigued, Geordi attempts to touch the meteorite but ends up burning his fingers. In a daydream, Geordi envisions selling the meteorite to a local college department of meteors in hopes of paying off his $200 bank loan. To be cautious, he pours water on the meteorite, causing it to crack open and release a glowing blue liquid. In another daydream, Geordi imagines the Department of Meteors refusing to buy his broken meteorite. Determined to fix it the next day, Geordi casually pours the liquid into the soil, unknowingly making contact with his skin. As time passes, Geordi notices grass-like growth overtaking his fingers. He considers calling a doctor, but fears they will amputate his affected fingers without anesthesia in his daydream. The mysterious growth continues to spread over Geordi's farm, everything he has touched, and even his own body, causing intense itching. Panicking, Geordi attempts to calm himself by drinking a mixture of vodka and orange juice before passing out in a drunken state. When Geordi wakes up later, he hopes the ordeal was just a dream. However, he soon realizes that the plant growth has infiltrated his house and discovered a green beard on his reflection in the mirror. Seeking relief from the itching, Geordi prepares a bath, but is visited by the ghost of his deceased father, who warns him against it, revealing that the water is what the plants desire. Realizing his fate is already sealed, Geordi reluctantly accepts that he is doomed. Unable to bear the unbearable itching on his skin any longer, Geordi gives into temptation and submerges himself into the bathwater. The following morning, Geordi's farm is completely covered in thick layers of the alien vegetation, and Geordi himself has transformed into a human-shaped mass of plant matter. Filled with despair, he reaches for a coach gun, prays for a stroke of luck, and ends his own life. Immediately after, a television weather forecast predicts moderate temperatures and heavy rains as the plants spread to other towns along the road. If you watch this, it's super goofy, and it's mostly just comedic, in my opinion, until obviously the end is pretty dark. Stephen King was told by Romero to play Geordi like Wile E. Coyote, the way he looks when he falls off a cliff, which if you go and watch it, that's exactly how he does it. So it's like, okay, well, actually, he did a really good job based on, you know, what he was told to do. He actually had an allergic reaction to the makeup for Geordi's transformation. He was subjected to shots of medication so that it would be bearable. If you watch the TV, and there's a lot of notable things on the TV, which are really cool. One in particular that I thought was cool, there's a priest on the TV, and he's actually the brother of the cinematographer, Michael Gornick, and who was actually a priest in real life. So that was the coolest thing that I thought was on the TV in the background. There's a lot of other cool things that you should go and look up, but that was a cool one. So episode 3 is called Something to Tide You Over, and this is the reason that I watched this, because Leslie Nielsen is the star of this one. So I'm just going to go over the quick episode, and then I want to talk about it after. So Richard Vickers, who is Leslie Nielsen, a wealthy and heartless millionaire, hides his cruel and murderous nature behind a facade of lively humor. He pays a visit to Henry Wentworth, the man who is involved in an affair with Richard's wife, Becky. Richard dismisses any genuine affection between him and Becky, but his main concern is always maintaining possession of what he considers his. To assert his control over Henry, Richard plays a recording of Becky's desperate pleas for help. Both men then travel to Richard's secluded beach house, where Richard points out what appears to be a grave in the sand. When Henry investigates, Richard pulls out a gun and forces Harry to bury himself alive. After burying Harry up to his neck below the high tide line, Richard sets up surveillance equipment to record him. He also reveals that Becky is buried nearby, with the rising tide already engulfing her face. Richard informs Harry that they have a chance of survival if they can hold their breath long enough for the sand to loosen once the water covers them. With that, Richard leaves Harry and returns to the comfort of his house, savoring his sadistic satisfaction as Harry and Becky slowly drown. Just before Harry is completely submerged, he looks into the camera and vows revenge on Richard. Later, Richard returns to collect his recording from Harry's supposed burial site, only to find a ruined monitor and no sign of Harry. Unfazed, Richard assumes that the current has carried away the body. However, he soon hears mysterious voices calling his name and realizes that someone has bypassed his elaborate security system. To his horror, he discovers that Harry and Becky, now waterlogged and covered in seaweed, have returned to seek vengeance on their killer. Richard shoots at them, but his bullets have no effect. Fleeing to his bedroom, Richard barricades himself, only to find Harry and Becky already inside. The two victims mock Richard, who responds with insane laughter. Eventually, the undead lovers bury Richard up to his neck on the beach. They disappear into the surf together, leaving Richard's video camera, now covered in seaweed, to capture his impending demise. As the tide rises and drowns him, Richard screams hysterically, claiming that he can hold his breath for a long time. So this was so impressive to me. Honestly, probably the most impressive thing I've seen Leslie Nielsen in, because I already know he's so good at comedy. He is hilarious. His timing is perfect. His deadpan is amazing. But watching him be the villain in a horror movie was impressive to me. Just seeing his range of just sadistic and evil behavior, just, and then also pure fear back to sadistic laughter, was very impressive to me. I was impressed with his acting and his range. And I realized that this is right around the time that he shifted his career to comedy. And it makes me wonder, because he was also in another horror movie in 1980, Prom. It makes me wonder if he was trying to decide whether he wanted to shift his acting career to horror or comedy. And it makes me wonder what it would be like if he was in horror forever. And he would have done a great job, but I'm glad he went to comedy, because he does so good at comedy, and that would just be tragic if we missed out on Leslie Nielsen comedy. So it was wonderful. So fun facts about this episode: an alternate ending, scripted but then rewritten for Something to Tide You Over, found two policemen dropping by to investigate Richard's panicky but true claim of Harry and Becky invading his beach house. When the policemen predictably laugh at his story, thinking he's drunk, Richard attempts to prove this by showing them the camera footage of both undead stalkers. Instead, the television plays his incriminating conversation with Harry before and during the latter's burial by the sea. Obviously, Leslie Nielsen did amazing. He was all business during the scenes, but he also brought a fart machine in his pocket to the shooting. He would set it off during rehearsals and just before the director George A. Romero would call action, causing Ted Danson and the crew to just crack up with laughter. And I love that even though he was in such a scary, sadistic horror movie, he was able to just be humorous. And it's just a fun testament to his humor. Richard Vickers, who, I mean, is Leslie Nielsen, had an aquarium in his home where a lionfish is seen. Later in The Naked Gun from the Files of Police Squad, 1988, Frank Drebin kills Vincent Lugwood's lionfish by accident. So that's just a funny nod in Police Squad to the lionfish in the back of his, because Vincent Ludwig is a sadistic person, and it's funny that Leslie Nielsen has, as a sadistic character, also has a lionfish in the background. Ted Danson, who plays Harry Wentworth in this episode, said in a television interview that his daughter was on the set of the scene where his character returns from the dead, encased in rotting flesh and seaweed. He purposefully tried avoiding his young daughter out of fear of scaring her. Finally, despite his best efforts, she went up to him, looked at him, and simply said, "Oh, hi, Dad." And I feel like that's something that my kids would do too. They just aren't as scared of things as I think that they would be. Okay, so the next episode was, I would say, the darkest one, but I also enjoyed it. If it wasn't for Leslie Nielsen being in the third episode, I think this one would be my favorite. So this is called The Crate. Mike, a janitor at Horlocks University, accidentally drops a quarter and rolls behind a grate under a basement staircase. While trying to retrieve it, he stumbles upon a wooden storage crate hidden under the staircase. The crate is labeled Ship to Horlocks University via Julia Carpenter, Arctic Expedition, June 19, 1834. Mike immediately contacts Professor Dexter Stanley to inform him of the discovery, causing Dexter to leave a faculty social gathering. At the gathering, Dexter's best friend, Professor Henry Northrup, is present with his unpleasant and intoxicated wife, Wilma, or Billy. Billy consistently embraces herself and mistreats her husband, causing Henry to often fantasize about harming her, although ultimately he decides not to do so. Stanley meets Mike at Amberson Hall, where the crate is located. Together they move the crate to a nearby biology lab and begin attempting to open it. In the process, Mike accidentally puts his hand inside the crate and screams in pain. The crate finally opens, revealing a small, savage creature with sharp teeth. Shockingly, the creature swiftly kills and devours Mike, leaving only his mangled boot behind. Panicked, Dexter encounters a graduate student, Charlie Gearson, and urgently shares what happened. Although skeptical, Charlie agrees to investigate the professor's claims. They arrive at the lab to find it covered in blood, with no sign of the creature or its crate. They locate the creature under the stairs again, where they also discover Mike's boots. Charlie decides to examine the crate more closely to measure the bite marks on the boot. Suddenly, the creature pounces on Charlie, killing him instantly. Dexter manages to escape, taking the boot with him.
Just a quick thank you to our sponsors, Helperly Connect. Helperly Connect is an online platform for adults over the age of 60 to be able to come together and connect and get to know each other. There's activities and there's things that you can learn, like piano and yoga. These classes are run by professionals of the industry, and it's such a good opportunity for connection. So if you're over the age of 60, or if you know somebody who might benefit from this program that's over the age of 60, go ahead and click the link in the description and sign up now. It's free.
Overwhelmed with trauma, Dexter rushes to Henry's house after Billy leaves for the night. He recounts everything that has occurred since the discovery of the crate and insists that the creature must be dealt with. Viewing the creature as a convenient means to rid himself of his wife, Henry seems to believe Dexter's story. He proceeds to spike Dexter's drink with a sleeping pill and write a false note claiming Dexter assaulted a female student. This prompts Billy to rush to Amberson Hall, where Henry has already cleaned up the bloody lab. When Billy arrives, Henry lures her under the basement stairs, hoping to awaken the creature. As Billy confronts Henry for dragging her out in the middle of the night and attacking her, the creature awakens and devours her. The morning after the horrifying events, Henry updates Dexter on his actions. He assures Dexter that he has successfully contained the savage creature inside the crate and disposed of it in a nearby quarry. Henry recounts how he watched as the crate sank to the bottom, believing that the creature has drowned. Both men agree that it's best to let the authorities handle the mysterious disappearances. Little do Henry and Dexter know, the beast is far from defeated. Unbeknownst to them, the creature is shown to be alive and well. Its primal strength allows it to tear the submerged crate apart, freeing itself from the watery prison. Tom Savini is spent over an hour and a half on the phone with Rob Botton seeking guidance, constructing Fluffy, the animatronic creature from the crate. This creation marks Savini's first venture into fully animatronic creatures. Botton, known for his work on notable films such as The Thing, The Howling, and The Total Recall, provided valuable advice to Savini through their conversation. Tom was the shorter garbage man featured in the movie's ending, so that's fun that they actually added him into the movie. And I think it's cool that they used somebody who had never done it before. Maybe they were desperate, but they did it. He did a great job, especially for the time, and it was very impressive to see. I think that it's really cool. There's like a lot of analogies in the episode The Crate. There, I mean, his boxed up rage is an analogy to the boxed up monster, in that letting it out. I mean, and I also have a theory that's not probably real at all, but it was fun to like imagine this theory throughout, that Henry actually was the monster. His friend Dexter was safe. He was safe from the monster, but everybody else was not safe. And it made me think, I mean, he was alone in there with the monster for such a long time and was totally safe, did not feel threatened in any way. And it makes me wonder if there was supposed to be some sort of analogy in there. Probably not, but I thought it was an interesting thought. Episode 5 is entitled They're Creeping Up on You. This is for sure my least favorite episode, but also super impressive cinematography. This has a lot of fun facts that I'm going to get to. But it's also, it just goes to show Stephen King's willingness to write things that we're scared of. And he does a good job with this one. Upson Pratt is an exceedingly cruel and germophobic business tycoon who lives in a meticulously sealed penthouse apartment. His living space is equipped with electrical locks and surveillance cameras, cutting him off from the outside world. He communicates primarily through telephone, often tormenting his subordinates. His character draws inspiration from Howard Hughes. One stormy night, Pratt receives a call from George, one of his employees, informing him about Pratt International's successful corporation taking over Pacific Aerodyne. He also reveals that the takeover has driven Norman, a rival businessman, to take his own life. Pratt takes perverse pleasure in the news. During the call, Pratt begins to notice cockroaches appearing in his apartment. As an insect hater, Pratt arms himself with bug spray to combat the unwanted pests. Soon, he receives an unexpected call on his private line. The call turns out to be Lenore, the grieving widow of Norman. Lenore tearfully recounts her husband's final moments and directs her curses towards Pratt for his role in causing the death. It's just very sinister how much he mocks her in this moment while she talks about her husband dying and it being ultimately his fault. As Pratt discovers cockroach remnants in his food processor, he contacts his building superintendent, Carl, who is on vacation. Despite being away, Pratt coerces him into sending the handyman, Mr. White, to call the exterminator under the threat of termination. The situation worsens when Pratt finds more cockroaches in a box of cereal. As he tries to crush them, Mr. White arrives at Pratt's door and, adopting a mocking tone, informs him that he has called a fumigation service. A power outage then plunges the building into darkness. In the midst of the blackout, an overwhelming swarm of hundreds of thousands of cockroaches emerge from every crevice in Pratt's apartment. Desperate, Pratt activates the emergency power and attempts to contact the police for help. Unfortunately, the blackout hinders any assistance from reaching him, including Mr. White, who is trapped in the elevator. At his wit's end, Pratt retreats to a climate-controlled panic room to escape the relentless swarm. Lenore calls him again, continuing to hurl curses his way. As Pratt answers the call, he notices movement under his bed covers. Removing them, he discovers the panic room has already been invaded by the cockroaches. With no means of escape, Pratt faces his swarm head-on, which triggers a fatal heart attack. After the power is restored in the building, the apartment becomes completely free of cockroaches. Inside the panic room, Pratt's lifeless body is discovered by Mr. White, who contacts the authorities to report the incident. Receiving no response from Pratt, Mr. White makes a sarcastic comment asking if the bugs have silenced him. To his horror, Pratt's corpse starts to convulse as cockroaches emerge from his mouth and chest, filling the panic room once again. Desperate for a reply, Mr. White repeatedly calls out Pratt's name, resorting to calling him a derogatory term when met with silence. So this one was so creepy. It was so hard to watch this. It's so impressive what they were able to do in a Creepshow special feature from the pages of Sin Fantastic magazine. At around the time of the movie's release, Stephen King and George A. Romero revealed that the film's story, They're Creeping Up on You, if it had been too difficult and ambitious to film, it would have been substituted with Stephen King's short story, The Hitchhiker, which ended up being a final story of Creepshow 2 in 1987. Directed by George A. Romero, cinematographer in the movie Michael Gornick. During a fan expo in Canada in 2015, George A. Romero had said that the cockroaches were the most expensive part of the movie, stating that the cockroaches cost 50 cents a piece and that they used more than 250,000 of them, a grand total of $125,000 on roaches alone, which, I mean, was crazy. To see that many roaches just in his house, in his body, was the most disturbing, for sure. So the epilogue, so this is concluding the very first part of the story, the prologue, where the boy had the magazine taken away from him by his dad. So the following day, two garbage collectors stumble across the discarded Creepshow comic book while on their route. As they flip through its pages, they come across an enticing advertisement for X-ray specs and a Charles Atlas bodybuilding course. Their attention is also drawn to the previously glimpsed voodoo doll advertisement, but they realize with disappointment that the order form has already been used. Meanwhile, inside the Hopkins residence, Stan grumbles to his wife about a stiff neck, assuming that he must have strained it somehow. Unbeknownst to him, Billy, upstairs, has obtained the voodoo doll and adorned it with fragments of his father's clothing and a lock of his hair. As Billy gleefully pricks the doll with a pin, Stan suddenly experiences intense pain in his throat when Billy finally exacts revenge for his father's abuse. The image of Billy tormenting the voodoo doll became the cover art for the upcoming Creepshow issue, the creep himself depicted on the cover holding the very same comic book, emitting a sinister laugh as a candle ominously extinguishes. This is like just a creepy story altogether, and Stephen King's son does a pretty good job at playing this character. He's a creepy kid. It was really good. I think this was a really awesome collaboration they decided to do this movie. They had some other ideas. George Romero obviously is such an impactful person on horror films. He created The Night of the Living Dead, which is iconic, and among other very iconic shows. They decided that him and Stephen King were going to do a collaboration, and they had some ideas. They thought about doing Salem's Lot. They thought about doing The Stand. But George Romero actually decided that it would be a cool idea to do an anthology. I mean, it really was a hit, a huge hit. So it was a good idea. They had some awesome stories. He asked Stephen King if he could write up the screenplay, and Stephen King said that he would be happy to do it and that he would need 60 days to write it up. And at the end of the 60 days, he was true to his word. He had the script written up, but according to Stephen King, it actually only took him 2 weeks to do it. So it's impressive, and it's just fun. And I feel like the excitement of having a collaboration with someone that big, even though Stephen King was that big, he's like, okay, I do not want to disappoint. I'm going to have this ready. And he did, and they delivered on a really crazy show that was awesome. And I loved the comic book style that kind of added some cheese to it, but also was like really fun and just such a homage to like the comic books from the 1950s. It was just an impressive show. I really enjoyed it. Thank you guys for recommending it to me. This is actually the only George A. Romero film to open up at number one in the weekend box office, which is really, I mean, I think Warner Brothers did a good job at making sure that it was released at the right time. I don't think it would have been the same if they had released it the same week as Halloween 3. So, okay, thank you for listening. If you have any questions, go ahead and message me on my Instagram. I will respond if it's a serious question. Let me know what other recommendations you have for funny movies or for bonus episodes like this one.